X-Cast, X-Files, Podwatch, episode 82. Today we're going to be talking about the last two episodes of season 7, Je Souhaite and Requiem. I'm your host, Sarah Blair, and with me is Darren Mooney. Hi, Darren. I feel like it's been ages since we've spoken last. How are you?
I'm grand. It's been almost an entire season. It's been over an entire season.
Yeah, right? All right, first, let's talk about Je Souhaite. This episode originally aired May 14th, 2000, and it was written and directed by the illustrious Vince Gilligan. Did you know that I am a huge fan of his?
I think we talked about it very briefly when we were talking about Three of a Kind, but I think most people really like Gilligan. He's just a phenomenal writer and director. And apparently, it's really great when you have somebody like that and you read interviews, and apparently everyone's like, he's such a sweetheart as well. You're like, there is nothing to hate about this man.
Exactly. Yeah. As a writer, I just love everything he has to offer, and a huge fan of all of his shows. So yeah, what did you think about Je Souhaite?
Well, first of all, in terms of writing, I think this is very much, it reminds me a lot of the episode at the end of the ninth season, which is the Brady Bunch episode, which I can't remember the name of off the top of my head now. Sunshine Days, that's it exactly. So it reminds me a lot of Sunshine Days, because it feels a bit like it's an attempt to say goodbye to a certain version of the X-Files, because this is the last standalone case that Mulder and Scully investigate, because obviously Duchovny, without getting too spoilery, is going to leave at the end of the next episode, Requiem. Now he'll come back, but this is the last time that the X-Files will be like a traditional Monster of the Week investigated by Mulder and Scully. And I feel like it's appropriate that Gilligan did this. And like a lot of the seventh season, when they're producing it, there was a sense that they didn't know whether or not the show was going to end that year. So there was a lot of like, well, it's the last year, so we got to do some stuff. You know, we'll finally let Vince Gilligan write his X-Cops episode. We'll finally explain what happened to Samantha Mulder. And with Je Souhaite, it's kind of like Gilligan seems to have been, well, okay, well, I will finally direct an episode. First of all, for a directorial debut, it's very good. And watching it, actually, it's interesting because you see a lot of the directorial style that he will bring to his work on, say, Breaking Bad or Better Call Saul, where, like, there's the great opening scene of the golf cart driving through the lots of these sort of, you know, storage hunter-style storage sheds, U-Haul or whatever, but they're blue, the doors are blue, and the sky is blue. So you have this sort of weird, almost fairy tale sort of color quality to it that reminds me a lot of like the use of color in Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, where you have these strong, vibrant primary colors that lend something that makes it feel almost unreal. And it kind of makes sense because you're going to segue then into a story about a genie, which is very much like the X-Files always sort of like bent the realms of what was possible and what was not. But the fact that this is an episode about a genie is perhaps one of the most audacious and unrealistic and sort of like out there episodes of the X-Files in a season that included first-person shooter. And I feel like it works very well in that sense. And I feel like Gilligan's direction, while, to, you know, it's still not as finely honed as, say, his work on when he directed, like, Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad, it's a lot of potential. And I think that it's interesting because one of the things Carter did was he encouraged his writers to get more involved in the process of their episodes. Like, when a writer was handed an episode, they were traditionally in charge of seeing it through from, like, the beginning through to the end. There's the famous story, Squeeze, the third episode of the first season, where James Wong and Glenn Morgan got into a row with the director of the episode, and Wong apparently, allegedly, edited the episode or was heavily involved in the editing of the episode in order to save it, for example. And, like, Darren Morgan has talked about the end of the episode as a final rewrite on the story. And, like, there's a sense that, like, this is the logical extension of that, is that you have these little nuggets of television that are essentially, like, auteurist in nature. Like, this is the pure vision of Vince Gilligan. And it's really great. And it's one of the things I really like about The X-Files is you have that room for unique voices and unique sensibilities while fitting within the same sort of framework of the show.
Absolutely. Yeah. Beautifully said. Just to go back to a little bit about what you said with the colors and the vibrancy of the sky and everything. One of the things that I really liked was that the carpet was sort of this faded, old, dusty carpet, which really went along with Vision's sort of feeling about the world, where she had been, you know, alive so long, and she was just sort of faded and tired and just wanted to be observing the world from afar and not having to grant wishes anymore.
It's like a mundane magical realism, mm-hmm. which I think works really, really well.
This is the episode where whenever I do a rewatch, this is the one I stop on.
We'll talk about why you don't stop on Requiem when we get to Requiem, but
There's a whole thing with that. So when I get to the end of this episode, I feel like this is just a great episode to end the series on, because it covers Mulder and Scully's friendship. It gives Scully, finally, after all this time, she gets her chance to have something scientifically proven in her hands, this amazing phenomenon that she's so excited about, this invisible man. And she just has, I love how she has so much fun with it. And
yeah, putting the paste on, putting the, right. The fingerprint dust. But again, we talked about, what was it, Three of a Kind, where Anderson is just having great fun. And it's impossible not to love scenes of Anderson having fun as Scully. It's just...
Exactly. You can just feel the joy coming through. It's just palpable. That was one of my favorite parts about this episode. But overall, I feel like it sort of encapsulates like the fun aspect of the Mulder-Scully relationship.
The closing image of the episode. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, it's just a beautiful way to leave Mulder and Scully sitting on the couch sharing a beer, watching a man movie. Like, as we talked about this, I think, earlier on, when we were talking about The Unnatural, it's like Mulder and Scully as two people who enjoy each other's company, whether or not you believe that's romantic or just platonic or whatever, but like two people who are meant to be together and who sort of fit together perfectly and have found each other in the world, sitting down with a bowl of popcorn and a couple of beers, having a good time. Like, that's the way that I would happily leave Mulder and Scully.
Exactly. Know? Yep. I totally 100% agree. And that's why I feel that way about this episode, because if I can just pretend the rest of it doesn't exist, then they get their happily ever after. Regardless of, like, the sexy times or anything like that, whatever. Like you just said, they're just two humans who have found happiness being in each other's company, and that's what matters, you know? And so, yeah, that's how I want to envision the rest of their lives together and without all the rest of it. You know?
You can imagine the sexy times happening after the beer and the popcorn.
Oh, absolutely. It's not exclusive. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. No. So, and I do. So, what are some of your other favorite parts about it? Like,
there are some things that sort of almost skirt a line for me with this episode, because I love how dark the sense of humor is in this episode. Like, for example, there's the great scene where Anson and Leslie Stokes are, like, trying to figure out what they want the third wish to be. And, like, Jen is pointing out that, like, Leslie is in a wheelchair. He cannot walk. He's been in it, presumably, like that for years. And she's like, well, if only you could imagine what wish you could use right now, while pointing at Leslie in the wheelchair. And his brother is completely oblivious to this. And eventually, like, later on, when Leslie gets the wish himself, he's like, He finally seems to twig what it is. I could wish for a gold wheelchair. And then there's a bit where he, at the very end, just before Anson, who's been zombified and feels cold, like, lights the gas cooker and burns the whole place down. That's the moment where Leslie realizes he could wish to walk again, which is an incredibly dark, a really, like, pitch black joke. And it kind of, part of me is like, that is hilarious. It's also horrible, but it's kind of hilarious. And there's
it's totally element. Hilarious. It's not kind of. It's absolutely hilarious.
It is.
Yeah.
There are times when Gilligan's generally quite good. He's generally quite humanist and quite optimist and stuff. But there's something very cynical about his portrayal of the Stokes brothers in this episode, where they genuinely seem, like, there's something very mean about the way that he treats the Stokes brothers. And to be fair, Anson and Leslie are horrible people. And the way that they treat Jen sort of justifies treating them as horrible people. But there is something very mean and very sort of, perhaps a bit sort of grisly and sort of, like, harsh, I think, in the way that the episode, like, humiliates Anson and Leslie time and time again. And again, they deserve it. It's made quite clear that Jen is basically a slave and they are using a slave.
Mm-hmm.
So they get what's coming to them. But there is something deliciously horrible and black and sort of, like, pitch black at the heart of the episode, despite all the fun stuff with Scully brushing down the corpse and despite, like, that great shot of Mulder and Scully at the end. So I like that there's this little kernel of darkness in the episode.
Mm-hmm. We talked about the ending of the episode we talked about? What else do we need to talk about? Oh, Mulder's wishes. That's right. We need to talk about wishes.
Which are just fantastic. It's such a clever thing. It's such a clever sort of genre thing. Like, the idea of a genie, it's basically the monkey paw situation. So you have a monkey paw, and it grants the wishes in the worst possible manner possible. You know, it's like, it's the famous story, the horror story. It's from the 20s, I believe, where, mm-hmm. like, a family gets a monkey paw that will grant three wishes, and those three wishes are, you know, they're horrible. Like, so they wish to be rich, and their son dies, and they get an insurance payoff, and they wish for their son to come back to life, and he comes back as a zombie, which is directly referenced here with, yeah. I think, Anson coming back as a zombie. And it's that great moral of, like, be careful what you wish for, because you just might get it, which is really mean-spirited, by the way, because, you know, I can be careful what I wish for, because I just might get it, or I could wish for it, and you could give it to me in the way that I intend to receive it.
But isn't that, like, the universe, basically, yeah. you know... It's sort of almost a play on the selfishness of humanity, yeah. but we can't help but being selfish because it's about survival, really, when you break it all down.
And I like that the episode like plays that through to its logical conclusion, because Mulder is obviously, well, first of all, he's smarter than the Stokes brothers, but he's also familiar with how the genre operates. Like, he's obviously read The Monkey's Paw and stuff. So you have, like, you have the great scene where he tries to figure out how to make a proper wish. And it's just this legally binding contract that just spools on and on and on. And it's like, and then, you know, obviously he comes to the realization at the end that if you have to work that hard to get your wish to work, then the point is that the wish shouldn't work, you know?
Exactly.
But I like that the episode goes to the point of having Mulder, because Mulder, that is a very Mulder thing to do, which is, like, Mulder being stubborn to the point of refusing to understand what's actually in front of him because he wants to believe that he's smart enough to make it work in the way that he wants it to work.
Isn't that sort of indicative of his whole personality, though? Because yeah. this whole time, on the entire series, he just wants to make this alien conspiracy work. He wants to find the truth. He is relentless. He wants to, you know, get this wish perfect, and he yeah. knows he can do it if he just tries hard enough.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you've got Scully, and she just comes in and drops a truth bomb and walks right back out, and he's like, okay, I get it, Scully.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because it is, because I mean, one of the defining aspects of Mulder's character is that, like, and I like Mulder a lot. I think he's a decent human being, but he's also repeatedly willfully oblivious to the incredibly obvious things. Like, there are points in the season, in the series, where, for example, he's completely blind to the fact of how much Scully has lost. He commits wholeheartedly to things, and like in this, he commits wholeheartedly to the idea of making the wish work. So he's completely blind to the fact that Jen is basically a slave until at the very end he realizes it and does the right thing. And I think that's a really nice Mulder sort of character beat, is that, like, he's not mean, he's not vindictive, he's not horrible, because he wishes for world peace. Like, he does, as much as Jen might pick apart that he's doing it because of for an ego trip, like, Mulder genuinely does want the world to be a better place, but he's just, because he's so focused, he's oblivious to, like, something that's right in front of him. You talked about how this is the perfect place to leave Mulder and Scully, and in many ways it is, and part of that is because it has that perfect Mulder journey, where it's like he realizes what was really important, that the truth was right in front of him all along, but he just got so lost in his obsession. I have a question for you, Sarah. Why do you end your viewing with Jesuit and not with Requiem? What is the problem with Requiem?
Here is my deal with Requiem. I was very extremely bitter about David Duchovny leaving the show, and I wanted to be in denial of that fact. I mean, I saw it the one time, and I was like, Mulder gets abducted, that's it. Like, I watched this as a teenager. I was, not really a teenager, but yeah, I was 18 when this show aired. I was like, this is my favorite show, and it's not going to be the same without Mulder, and I refuse to accept this. So for all this whole time, 17 years, I refused to watch that. And then finally, I was doing my Blair Watch project for the show and decided to go through season 8 again and finally sat down and watched it. And it's such a good episode. I'm so mad at myself because the Skinner angst is worth everything.
Poor suffering Skinner. Can he suffer more? Oh. He can always suffer more.
Yeah, so, you know, there you go. That's my reason. You're welcome.
That's good, actually. That's a pretty good reason, to be honest. One of the things I like about Requiem is the fact that it serves... It was written at a time when they didn't know whether Duchovny was coming back, because he only announced he was coming back when he settled the seventh season behind the scenes is a horror story.
It's a train wreck, right?
Yeah, it is, because you have, the situation of Fox, where Fox are so screwed because they hired Doug Herzog, they have no continuing shows except pretty much The X-Files and The Simpsons, so they literally cannot afford to let The X-Files end on its seventh season, despite the fact that everyone working on it really wants it to. And then at the same time, you have Duchovny, who's embroiled in a lawsuit against Carter, because he thinks that Carter, swindled him out of money for reruns on FX, because he's part of a conspiracy, appropriately enough, with Fox. And at the same time, while that is all happening, you have Duchovny writing episodes with Carter writing episodes in which they are very clearly taking swipes at one another. So I think you can see a lot of Duchovny swiping at Carter in, say, Hollywood AD, where you have this sort of sellout hippie dude. And you can see, I think you can see a lot of Carter swiping at Duchovny when he's writing Fight Club, where you have two people who cannot be in proximity to one another without chaos breaking loose. And then you have the fact that Requiem was written at a time when they didn't know for sure whether the show was going to come back for an eighth season. They didn't know if the show came back for an eighth season whether Duchovny would be involved in it. They didn't know when they're going to try and transition to a series of movies, because I think Carter had wanted the sequel to Fight the Future to be released in 2000, which really wasn't viable in April of or May of 2000 when they're writing this. They didn't know what context the episode was going to be received in until it was actually broadcast, which is just remarkable for a piece of television. So it was written in a way that it had to serve as A, potentially a seventh season finale leading into an eighth season, B, a seventh season finale leading into a series of feature films, or C, as the last ever episode of The X-Files. And that's a lot of weight to put in an individual episode. And I kind of think that it works relatively well in those three ways. It's the episode where Mulder is abducted, but I feel like Mulder being abducted, while it becomes... I love the eighth season. I actually really, really like the eighth season. But I feel like Mulder being abducted is the perfect place to end his character arc. Because, from the outset, he's been the guy who's chased the unknown, who's chased aliens, who's wanted to touch and wanted to prove that the unknown exists. And, one of the ironies of the X-Files has been that, Scully has been abducted. Scully the skeptic, and Mulder was left behind. And, that Mulder's sister was abducted and he was left behind. And so it feels like the end of Mulder's journey is actually him being abducted at the end of the episode. That he finally gets to experience firsthand this thing that he's been chasing for so long. He finally gets, because Truth and Proof was never really about proving it to anybody else. Because, obviously, the conspiracy is never exposed to the world. There's never any episode about, Watergate-style revelation about the conspiracy and colonization of the mythology and stuff like that. Instead, it's about Mulder sort of coming to terms and accepting himself. And Requiem is the episode where Mulder gets to be abducted himself. And it feels like, for me, that would almost be the perfect place to leave the X-Files. And it's weird because I imagine an alternate universe where the show had ended on this, in the same way that Twin Peaks ends with, say, Dale Cooper going into the Black Lodge. And maybe 20 years later, having the X-Files revival pick up from the end of Requiem rather than from the Truth, and having Mulder wander out of the woods 20 years later. And sort of, I'm wondering, would that have been a better way to end the show, and would that have been a better way to start a revival than what we got? It's ironic because in the years leading up to the end of the X-Files, I would have been happy with Requiem being the last episode of the X-Files ever produced. I would have been happy with Existence being the last episode of the X-Files ever produced. However, because that lottery ball landed on the Truth, the Truth is pretty much the only season finale since the seventh season that I would not be happy ending the show on. But guess what? That's it. That's where we're ending. It's just a clip show. But anyway, we're not talking about the Truth. Let's not
right. Exactly. Exactly. So, how do you feel about going back to the beginning?
I really like the sort of symmetry full circle aspect of it, but what I really like about it is the fact that first of all, it's Bellflower, Oregon, which from the first episode, that's where Carter grew up, actually. He grew up in Bellflower in California. But one of the things I like about Requiem is the sense that it captures, there's something uncanny and unreal about it, and it sort of plays through the seven seasons as a whole. There's a sense of reality is not what you take for granted. It's sort of reflected in Carter working on Harsh Realm and The Matrix and the 13th Floor and all these movies that were coming out at the same time where the world is uncanny or fake or not real. So when Mulder and Scully go back to Bellflower, Oregon in Requiem, right, it is clearly not the same Bellflower, Oregon that they visited in the pilot, because that one was in Vancouver and this one is in California. So you have this really weird disconnect where they are going back to the way things were, but it's also, it's not at the same time. It feels like Mulder and Scully and the show itself have changed. So even when they try to go back to the past, they can't quite recapture it. So you can do stuff like you can have the X on the road from the pilot, obviously, where Mulder spray painted it, marking it. And you can have actors return, like you can obviously have like Billy Miles come back, you know, Zachary Ansley come back. But you also have this sense of like things being fundamentally different. And I think that that's something really powerful about the episode, something that really sort of resonates with me, is the idea that like Mulder and Scully have changed fundamentally in the 7 years. And like there's a scene where Mulder and Scully comes in to visit Mulder in their motel room. And obviously that's mirroring the scene in the pilot, the really sort of creepy exploitation scene in the pilot where Scully comes in and Mulder has to look at her in her underwear to see if she's got like, you know, alien abduction marks, which is clearly something that was added when the network was like, can we make Gillian Anderson seem like more of a sex object? Is there a way to do that? And the show sort of steered away from that in later seasons. But here you have that play out again. And it's this really sweet scene where Scully comes in and she gets into bed and Mulder lies down and sort of cuddles next to her. And he basically has this reflection, having seen her with the baby, which I'm like, I have very mixed feelings about how the show treats Scully as a mother. I think that there's some very problematic stuff there. But that's stuff that you could talk about in like the fifth season and the ninth season. But I like the setting up of the idea that Scully gave up a family to work on the X-Files with Mulder, and Mulder sort of having that epiphany when he watches her with the baby and sort of like saying that to her, saying that like, look, you've given all this up to do this thing that we're doing, and like, is there a point to it anymore? And then at the end of the episode, having it revealed that she is pregnant, she's going to have a child. Like I feel like that's a very nice sort of structural bit of like symmetry and looping and sort of like storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Like you said, this episode would have been the perfect finale, I think. Is there anything else you want to add?
Not much, beyond the death of the cigarette-smoking man and the sort of, like, one of the things I like about the eighth season, and I think it's sort of set up in Requiem a little bit, is this idea that the show, no matter what happens after this, the show is going to be fundamentally different because Duchovny is not going to be around as much. Like, even, I think Carter knew when he was writing the episode that even if the show did come back for an eighth season, Duchovny would not be coming back in the same capacity that he was beforehand. And you get this sort of weird tension in the episode where what the bad guys really want in Requiem is to capture the UFO and to build a new conspiracy, because the cigarette smoking man explicitly compares it to like the Roswell crash. He sees it as something where he can build things back to the way that they used to be. And it happens a lot in the eighth season as well, where Krycek shows up with the vaccine and says, like, look, Skinner, if you abort Scully's baby, I'll revive Mulder. And we can go back to it being the same way that it always was. But there's this sense, like, there's this pull towards, like, making it familiar and making it the way that it was. But that comes from, like, the cigarette-smoking man and Alex Krycek. Whereas I think that Mulder and Scully and the show itself are aware of the fact going into Requiem that things are going to be fundamentally different and things are going to change. I really hate the ninth season. I have very mixed feelings on the revival. I really love the eighth season, actually, of all things. But I like this idea that the X-Files understood that growth and change were necessary. And Requiem kind of makes that argument where it's like, look, you can't capture that UFO and rebuild the conspiracy and have the mythology go back to the way that it was, because the world doesn't work like that. Things don't stay the same forever. Like, eventually something's going to happen, and eventually things are going to have to change, and this is going to be an ending of sorts. And Requiem is, because obviously Requiem is like a funeral mass. But it's just, I really like that aspect of the episode.
Yeah, it's overall, it's a really great episode, and I kind of feel sad that I missed out on it for so long. But I hope everyone else will enjoy our podcast and go back and rewatch it if you haven't already, because it's definitely worth taking the time to dig into a little bit. It's been definitely a pleasure talking with you, Darren, as always. And you can find us on @X_cast on Twitter, and let us know your thoughts about Requiem and Je Souhaite on our Facebook group. Coming up on our next episode, we'll be digging into season 8, and we'll absolutely be looking forward to having you all back with us tomorrow. Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, trust no one.